Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton. I have not one, but two incredibly exciting guests this week. And the first is the best, of course. Right, Bess?
Yes, I'm so happy to be here. Bess, it's always great to be on Inside
Levin,
the Hive.
Welcome back to the show. So before Bess comes on and talks to us about all the craziness going on in the world this week, and there's a lot of craziness this week. It's like a more crazy week than usual. After Bess, we have Rob Fishman, who's coming on. He is a former tech person who sold a company to Twitter for more money than I'll ever make in my whole life, and then came to Hollywood to try to disrupt it. And we're going to talk about why Hollywood is one of the most ridiculous industries on earth and how it manages to survive somehow. We'll get into it. It's a great, fascinating conversation. Bess, over to you.
Yes.
All right, where should we start? Pelosi, Barr, Julian Assange,
Jack Dorsey. I think we have to start with Dorsey because I'm worried about him, because I assume it's been, you know, several days since he's eaten anything.
So the story you're talking about is Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, who I wrote a book about many years ago, was interviewed this week, and somebody pulled together a bunch of his tweets and it was CNBC, right? Is that right? That they did this
I on? Believe it was CNBC. Yeah, he had appeared on a fitness podcast.
A fitness podcast, of all places, because that's what you do when you're the CEO of two public companies.
So, nothing but time.
Especially when the CEO of Twitter. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that were on that Dorsey said, and I will tell you why they're all bullshit.
So in terms of diet, he apparently, according to him, he only eats one meal a day, and that's around dinner time. I think it's, you know, some sort of small salad. Maybe I think he possibly said a little bit of dark chocolate, because obviously that's, you know, that's a popular thing to do, one square of dark chocolate. And he, rather than letting himself, you know, indulge a little bit on the weekends, he doesn't eat on the weekends at all. So he does a full weekend fast.
So essentially he is just surviving on air right now.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
He also, he walks to work, which is great, but, you know, he's not getting a lot of calories in, so that's somewhat worrisome. And he also, I think he sits in an ice bath, and then there's a sauna, there's a lot of sweating, and it's, you know, the internet is extremely worried that he has an eating disorder, and I'm a little bit worried about him too, although it feels very, very tech bro-y. He's very into, I think, like, the idea of punishing himself. You know, he had that weird silent retreat that he said was really painful, but also great. So I think this is part of that.
Okay, well, here's where I'm going to throw a little ice on the sauna. So one of the things he said, and look, I've known Dorsey for a long time, and the thing that's so frustrating about him is that he's actually a super smart guy, and he is, he does incredible things, he does incredible work, but he always has to kind of push things a little bit too far. And so, for example, his sauna that he said he takes, so he said that he does three saunas for 15 minutes apiece, and they are 220 degrees. Here's the first where I'm going to go, bullshit. This is the part that bothers me. It's not that Dorsey said it. It's that the CNBC reporter and everyone else who picked it up was like, oh, he takes three 15-minute, 220-degree saunas. If you bother to Google it, the last person to do a 230-degree sauna, which was in 2010, was in there for 6 minutes and died from burns. And another person that was in the same sauna for 6 minutes was in, like, had to be taken, flown to the hospital. Like, you cannot go into a sauna of 220 degrees for 45 minutes without dying. So
you think he's full of shit?
I think the whole thing is full of shit. I do not believe that you can survive off one fucking square of chocolate and a salad and not eat on weekends and go in and out of ice baths and walk backwards to work on your tiptoes. Like, I'm sorry. It just bothers me because Silicon Valley, these journalists, I wouldn't even call them journalists, half of them, it's like they just write whatever these people say. It's like,
right,
do a little fucking homework.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. I just had my...
So we're calling you out, Dorsey. We don't believe your sauna tales, your sauna regime. Yeah. He's also...
I'm sorry. Just one more thing. No one.
No, yeah.
No one on Earth. And there is not a single person on Earth that can eat just one square of dark chocolate. Okay? And I am saying this from experience. I buy like this fancy dandelion black chocolate and I end up eating the whole bar. And you just can't do it.
Oh, me too. I don't even... When I'm like buying one of those, you know, $7... bars of chocolate, I just go into it assuming I'm eating that whole thing in one sitting.
Exactly. So here's what I'm going to say is what's really going on. That Dorsey probably takes like a limo to work, you know, one of those ones with a hot tub in the back. Okay.
Yeah.
He probably eats like steak for breakfast he probably doesn't eat just one piece of dark chocolate. I bet you he like drinks it. I bet you he just pours it all over himself and licks it off like a pussycat.
Yeah.
The whole thing, I'm calling bullshit.
We're on to him.
We're on to him. All right. Let's move on to more important things. Because there are a few more important things. So what's going on? Can you explain a little to me about what is going on with Barr and Trump and the Mueller report and... if we're going to see it, and if it's just going to be a bunch of blacked out pieces of paper.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it seems like. So obviously, as everyone knows, Mueller submitted his report, was it 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago? It feels, I have no sense of time anymore in this era.
45 years ago, in dog years, in Trump years.
He submitted it, and then a few days later, so the report was something like 300 pages, and then Barr submitted a 4-page summary of it, which, you know, that's one thing. And so he said that Mueller did not find evidence of collusion or, you know, enough evidence that he could build a case, and he didn't draw a conclusion on whether Trump obstructed justice. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Mueller is saying, I don't know. Barr took it upon himself to say that he was not going to charge Trump with obstruction of justice. And a few people find that somewhat shady because back in June, he wrote he sent an unsolicited letter to the Justice Department, 19 pages, saying this whole idea that Mueller is investigating obstruction of justice is totally bullshit. He shouldn't be allowed to do this, blah, blah, blah. So not that surprising that given the choice between charging Trump with obstruction or not, he went with not. So
there's been a few people out there this week that have said things like, you know, why wouldn't Mueller speak up? You know, I mean, he spent his whole team. He spent 2 years, you know, exhaustively interviewing all these people. It's a 200-300-page document. It's is he just going to kind of let this play out, do you think, or is he going?
That's what it seems like. You know, he never talks to reporters at all in his entire career. He never does. There were no leaks this entire time from his people. And so, you know, I obviously understand and kind of agree with the people who are frustrated by him, who are saying, wait, what's going on here? It kind of seems I want to believe that he is like, you know what? I know what's in this thing and it's going to come out and I'm just going to let it play out. because it definitely seems like there's probably stuff that's not going to reflect well on Trump in there. I believe Barr said this week that next week there'll be a redacted version of it sent to Congress. I think he said that they'll never see a fully unredacted one. And Nancy Pelosi is not happy about that. And I think she said yesterday, we're going to get our hands on it one way or another. She is not a fan of William Barr. She, you know, has basically more or less called him a Trump toady, said he's going off the rails, and that she doesn't trust him at all. I mean, that's a verbatim quote. She said, I don't trust him at all. I trust Mueller. So, and you know, yesterday, I think people were pretty upset with Barr for kind of indulging in Trump's most absurd conspiracy theories that his campaign was spied on. And he said that he is going to be investigating that. Barr is. So that's interesting.
Well, so what do you think? So is there a world where someone on the special counsel, of course not Mueller, but is there a world where they just leak the whole thing, or is that just too dangerous?
I mean, I would think it would be dangerous, but you know, there was, I believe it was in the New York Times, that piece earlier this week where I think it was, coming from people on Mueller's team saying they were not happy with sort of the White House, their whole, total exoneration spiel, and not happy with Barr. And so, yeah, I think maybe. Obviously, it'll never come from Mueller, but I think there would be a chance that people on his team will just – they'll just start leaking stuff, perhaps.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to another topic in the news this week, Trump's taxes. We heard that – So what's happened and where are we, and are they going to see the light of day, or?
Well, the House committee, they requested them, and Trump immediately had his lawyer send a letter to, I believe, the IRS and possibly also the Treasury saying, you cannot do this. The Justice Department needs to review this request, et cetera, et cetera. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was testifying this week. And while he said that he intends to follow the law, he apparently believes that Congress doesn't really have a case here. And he is one of Trump's most loyal stooges. So I think he will do what he can to protect Trump's tax returns.
So do you think that they will come out, or do you think it's impossible? I mean,
I think that it's going to be a big legal battle and like possibly go to the Supreme Court.
So if you look at what's going on with the Trump administration right now, there are currently all these vacant positions. The defense secretary is vacant, DHS secretary is vacant, UN ambassador is vacant, FEMA director is vacant. Now the Secret Service director is vacant, ICE director, DHS director, deputy, so on and so forth. I mean, I can just keep going.
It's incredible.
I'm not even sure that there's a president that's not there in the office. But
mentally,
is this a strategy or is this just a byproduct?
It feels like a byproduct to me. You know, it doesn't seem there's always all this talk of when this White House or this administration does something crazy or whatever it is, that maybe they're actually playing three-dimensional chess. I think it's a byproduct. I don't know. I do think in terms of perhaps like the DHS vacancies, that is a little more strategic, because it just seems like Stephen Miller just wants to get rid of everyone who won't throw infants in cages and just remake DHS in his own white ragey image. But the other stuff is just it's just
white ragey,
you know,
image.
I think it's just I think the other stuff is just a total shit show. It's like amateur hour.
Yeah, it's beyond amateur hour. I think it's yeah. Okay, well, this leads me to we have a couple more questions, and then we'll let you get back to you know, your
very important work,
your ice baths, and eating yeah. And nibbling on one piece of chocolate as you walk to work, yeah. 15 miles uphill.
Yeah, I have to ration it.
Do you think that Trump? I know we can't talk about like who's going to win 2020, but do you think that
right?
One thing that I'm a little nervous about, and I think is probably what is going to happen is so there was an incident today where Trump Lou Dobbs had a he was doing his usual garbage show and he put on a graphic. I actually went on Lou Dobbs once and he was a really nice guy. And then,
wow.
And then I like so nice and thoughtful and kind. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I like saw him on his show the next day and I was like, wait, that was the guy I had a conversation with? He just like, seems like there's like two different Lou Dobbs. Anyway,
yeah.
Also his studio is really old and danky and looks like it hasn't been updated in a long time.
Not surprising.
So when you look at yesterday, today, whatever it was, Lou Dobbs had posted this graphic, and it said that Trump had a 55% approval rating and a 58% rating approval rating for the economy. So Trump then retweets it and says, "Amazing! Right. Look how amazing I am!" Right, with a screenshot right. of it. It turns out that yeah. whatever person decided to put that graphic up either lied or was a moron. I'm going to probably go with right. both. And it turns out that 55% right. number was the disapproval rating.
And that's amazing.
And that he has a 43% approval, a 41% approval rating, and most people disapprove right. of what he's doing, and only a 31% mm-hmm. like staunch approval rating, which is the same 31% mm-hmm. that would vote for him no matter what happens. So anyway, so right. now Trump's not going to go correct that. Right. All of his followers and everybody now sees that he has a 55% approval rating, and he probably will go to bed tonight believing that too. So the question
For
is,
sure.
do you think that when we kind of as we start to head into 2020, and you wrote a story recently about how Trump says that now that he's the staunchest person there is on the environment, which is total bullshit.
Yes.
Do you think that the Democrats will have to start to lie about things too, or something will happen that will change the way all the fake stuff coming out of the right will affect how the left yeah. responds?
I don't know. I mean, obviously we don't want them to stoop to Trump's level in terms of the lies and just the completely in unhinged statements and stuff like that. But I mean, I am very worried about 2020 because clearly Trump and his team, their strategies to lie about everything. Obviously, you referenced the story from the other day about how they've realized that among swing voters, not the base, obviously, but swing voters actually do care about climate change and not wanting to turn the planet into a urinal off the highway. And so they've just decided they're going to say, I've been amazing for the environment. Look at everything I've done. And they're just going to lie about everything. And I don't know. I don't think Democrats will turn to them. Maybe they will. I don't want them to. I want them to win. I don't know. But I'm nervous about 2020, Nick. That's where this is.
Yeah, I think that I'm terrified about it. I think yeah. that it's going to be a it's just going to be a shit show.
Right.
Across the board.
All
right. So last question. There yes. was finally after years of being holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange looked like a madman as he was dragged out.
Oh my God.
Today, that video footage, he looks like Willy Wonka if he like went into a retirement home and someone.
He looks like he's been living under a bridge.
Yeah.
It was a incredible before and after.
Yeah. And then of course Trump tweets, I don't know what WikiLeaks is, or something along those lines. He said he didn't know anything about WikiLeaks. Do you yeah. think that what we saw happen in 2016 was we saw all these outside influences kind of trying to influence the election. When
sure.
you look at 2020, you know, there while the highest level of our government will be happy to do anything they can to win. It seems like there are actually genuinely good people still working in the government, lots and lots of them, that are doing things to avert that. Do you think that, you know, with people like Assange no longer going to be in the picture, and all these and the people that were swept up in the indictments around Mueller, like, you know, Roger Stone and all those folks, do you think that there's a chance that we actually might see more normalcy, I guess, from this election when it comes to bad actors specifically on U.S. soil? Or will there be other squirmy, wormy people that will just rise to the occasion?
Like, do I think that Donald Trump Jr. is just going to be back to his old ways for 2020?
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, you would think that hopefully lessons would be learned from people who would like to avoid indictments, et cetera. But then, you know, when it comes to people like Donald Trump Jr., I think it's full steam ahead on the old strategy because, you know, they got away with it last time. Why not? Go 2 for 2. So I'm not sure. I think that there could still be people on Team Trump who, you know, it's these people who think they can get away with anything. Maybe they'll be slightly less obvious about it, but maybe not.
All right. Well, on that note, Bess Levin, it's time for us to go and sit in a 750-degree sauna and then jump into a negative 5,000-degree ice bath, which is what you and I do every day before we do our handstand walk to work.
It's how we get our best ideas. It's the secret sauce.
All right. Thank you so much, Bess. This is a fascinating conversation, as always. And stick around for Rob Fishman as we talk about Hollywood and how it deserves to be disrupted and if that will ever happen.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hype. How do I sound, Rob?
Like someone who's...
Professional?
Like someone who's had 5 cups of coffee.
I have had 5 cups of coffee because I got a new cappuccino machine, but let's just skip that. So, okay, I'm going to start by, before I explain who you are, I'm going to explain why you're here. So I have been covering different industries that have been disrupted for the last 15, 20 years, publishing, music, journalism, you name it. And I have never in my entire life, professional life, seen an industry as fucking stupid in the way it works as Hollywood. Hence, Rob Fishman, who is sitting across from me. And we're going to get into all of this in a second, and I'm going to explain more. So, Rob, you had a company you sold to Twitter, and now you have a company that you're doing in Hollywood. Give us like the 140-character version of that.
I will try. We look at ourselves as a coming-of-age network, similar to what you might have seen on the WB 20 years ago. We make teen-oriented shows that are distributed for free online for a large audience of Gen Z viewers.
So what makes you different, it's a couple of things. One is that you didn't start out in Hollywood, you started out in tech. You had a company that you ran that you sold to Twitter. You were there for a couple of years. That's the first thing. And the second thing is you're trying, and I would say successfully trying, to break the traditional studio model where you're not going through the same routes that most people go through. So we're going to get to all of that, but I want to start by kind of backing up a little bit and painting the room for how wasteful, I guess, Hollywood is, and how many problems it has as an industry, and how it got there. And I'm curious if do you want to kick that off a little bit?
Sure. I mean, you know, I can speak from what I know, which is probably limited compared to most people who are actually from and really deep in Hollywood. But, you know, in some ways we're not traditional, but in other ways we're like ultra traditional. When I really came out here and started thinking about how we could do television quality production at a price point that could become a sustainable business in the online era. I was pointed back to the studio system from, you know, the last century, from the beginning of the last century, 20s and the 30s, and I was recommended books like The Genius of the System and you know, they talked about MGM and all these studios that were starting then, which were really vertically integrated and everyone was kind of on staff, on payroll.
So wait, so back then they had essentially, they had a writer's room, right? They owned all the equipment. They had the lots, they had the extras, they had all these things. And yet today it's the complete opposite where they go out, they buy scripts, they throw 90% of them away. It's just like all waste to kind of to get one thing to market that may be successful.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like in many industries there, with the advent of technology, there's been a move toward consolidation and verticalization. And from what I can tell over the last 100 years, it's been the opposite. It's been a movement of fragmentation and inefficiency.
In Hollywood.
Correct.
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody said to me the other day, I was talking to a big movie exec, and I said, I was like, I don't get how the system works the way it does. And he was explaining it to me, and he said, you know, how do you think you make $1 billion in Hollywood? And I was like, how? And he said, you show up here with $10 billion, and, which I thought was a clever, funny line. But what he was saying was that, you know, this is one of the few industries, I guess you could say banking is different, but it's one of the few industries where the same companies that ran it 100 years ago still run it today, the same studios, but that it seems like there is this finally something that's kind of about to change where, you know, I don't know if it's going to be the way content is made, but maybe it is. I mean, one thing that I always think about is with Netflix, everyone says, oh, Netflix changed Hollywood. They haven't changed a fucking thing. They've changed the way you get your content. The way it's made is exactly the same.
Right. I mean, I think that people like Netflix have verticalized large chunks of the value system in terms of how content is distributed and, you know, frankly have flattened out a lot of sub-industries that existed in that part of the value chain. But I would agree with you when you look at the early piece of it, which is how are projects developed, how are they produced and edited, that part remains sort of mired in an antiquated model.
So why is it that the model exists that, like, when you look at, let's just say book publishing for a second. In book publishing, you write a proposal, you have an agent, you go out there, you get 10 people maybe that are interested, 3 people bid, 1 person buys the book, you write it. If it's a shitty book, they'll print 2,000 copies. If it's a great book, they print 50,000 copies and so on and so forth. It is a loss leader industry like most creative industries where 5% of the books pay for 95% of the failures, which is fine. But yet in Hollywood, you have an industry where most things are they are designed not even to get to the point of publishing. And how – the part I don't understand is why.
Well, I think there are models of scarcity and models of abundance. And, you know, when I used to work at the Huffington Post or wrote for BuzzFeed, you know, the idea was that you would publish a ton of articles and that the cost of each article was low and whatever bubbled up to the top would go viral and kind of pay for the rest of them. And I think that that's true of Hollywood too, which is like one big movie that's a blockbuster pays for your losses. But, you know, I think that was a model of abundance and Hollywood sort of a model of scarcity where there's, you know, some sort of limited pool of resources and the studios are not making that many movies a year. They're, you know, at least for a long time, the network only had so many slots that they were going to run each night of programming. And so I don't know. You know, I think that the short answer to your question is that TV shows and movies are a lot more expensive to make than books or journalism or any of those other fields.
But they're expensive to make because Hollywood chooses to make them expensive to make. Like, for example, what are the statistics about how much it costs a minute to make content and things like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, and, you know, this gets back to what we were talking about before, about what we're trying to do differently, which is make things for a few $1,000 a minute as opposed to a few $100,000 a minute, which is, you know, fairly standard out here, $50,000, $75,000, $100,000. And even for the new startups, and when I say startups, I mean the Netflixes or what Jeffrey Katzenberg is doing, who are, you know, supposedly challenging the model. The cost per minute is in some cases the same, some cases higher, some cases a little bit lower, but it's not a disruptive price point.
So the thing that I found so fascinating was when I came to your office studio, whatever it is, you have a little studio. You have a small group of set designers. You own your own camera equipment and lighting equipment and all these things. Now, if you were to go onto a movie set or a TV set, like I, you know, go to them all the time for work, it's, you know, here's a funny little anecdote. A friend of mine told me who was working on a show. They needed, I believe it was like metal detectors. They were in the middle of shooting a TV show, and someone said, the director or somebody said, we might try using metal detectors tomorrow on the shoot, so we should get some. But they weren't allowed to buy them because the union says that you can't buy these things. So they had to rent them, and they were like $5,000 a day for like 3 metal detectors. And then because they got the metal detectors, they had to have a metal detector expert come and. And because they got the metal detector expert, it was like it pushed the number of people on set over. So they had to get an additional food truck and an additional and all these different things. And next thing, and they didn't even use the metal detectors. And the guy was telling me it was like an extra $100,000 they must have spent as a result of this. It's almost like the system is designed to waste money. Whereas if someone were to kind of rethink it, couldn't they do it for a lot less money?
Well, I mean, that's what we've tried to prove to ourselves. I mean, I think that one of the things that makes Hollywood a special place is how many middlemen there are here to execute anything, right? And, you know, when you first come to Hollywood, you say to a writer like yourself, wow, you have a manager, an agent, a lawyer, a business manager, all these people. And that's just for a single sole proprietor. And writ large, when you look at Hollywood, there are guilds and agencies and you know, who knows what kind of making every production. All of those people are obviously taking their cut of whatever. So, you know, it's not a system, I think, designed for efficiency. It's a system designed for a lot of different players out here who subsist off these projects to earn a good living.
So do you think that when I look at the way technology disrupted all these other industries, you know, one thing that, let's just take music, the simplest one, you used to have to buy a whole CD. And one of the things they did was they were like, hey, you know what? Apple came along, they said, you can buy one song. Wow, that's a huge, amazing idea. With publishing, it was oh, you can download it onto a device rather than have to go buy the hardcover or the paperback and wait for the paperback. What do you think is going to happen with technology in the near future? Because I have ideas, of course, of what will happen in the far future that we can get to that will actually start to change the industry.
I think it's a really good question. I mean, I think that there remains a floor to where you can produce, you know, premium content at. And that floor is still expensive when you think about internet dollars. It's not expensive when you think about Hollywood dollars. Like I was saying to you the other day, we're in a funny spot where I think most people from Silicon Valley who back media companies, for instance, would look at our bottom line and say, whoa, like per minute, you're spending a lot more than a BuzzFeed or a Vice or folks who are, you know, spitting out articles and kind of digital video. Whereas someone from Hollywood would look at that same P&L and say, oh my God, like I spent that much on the first 5 minutes of one of my episodes as you spent the entire year, you know? And so that there's a huge amount of white space between what's seen as like digitally attractive versus what's seen as something that could be on Netflix or on HBO.
So do you think that when you look at the way content is created right now, while the Netflixes and the Amazon have changed the way it's distributed, do you think that they will actually go after trying to change the way that it is created too? Or are they just like, it's just whatever?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think we're sort of in the early stages of disruption of television and film where we're seeing people, you know, sort of innovate at the higher end. You're seeing a lot of people who want to be the next HBO, right? A lot of people, if, you know, HBO has their dragons, then Amazon's getting their Lord of the Rings, and I'm sure Netflix is following fast with their epic sci-fi fantasy series. What you're not seeing, and what I actually think is the most interesting part of this, is if you look at the last 100 years of what thrived on, you know, the boob tube, it was soap operas and cable TV and sitcoms and things that actually were not that expensive to produce from a below the line kind of physical perspective. And, you know, that's where I see us and a few other upstarts. But generally speaking, I don't see a lot of people trying to take the lower end of physical production, which I think actually accounted for the most mind share on the television set, and bring that online.
So,
And I think, you know, as a corollary, I think that that's where you'll be able to find the most efficiencies, build the biggest audiences, and through advertising, you know, create successful business models. I think if you're just taking dragons from the silver screen to the TV screen to the Netflix screen, there's only so much you can do in your cost model, no matter where people are watching it.
One thing that is really fascinating is when you mentioned to me, was it Crypt TV? So
yeah,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's my friend Jack's company. They, you know, I look at them as kind of a peer in the space. They do short form horror videos, and they're backed by folks including Jason Blum. And you know, they have a slightly different model than we do, but fairly similar, where they go to filmmakers who are either local or, you know, a little farther away, and give them a budget that makes sense in a digital ecosystem, and they're able to create characters like the Birch and others that have become wildly popular on Facebook or YouTube, and do that without, you know, being Universal making a $200 million horror movie.
And how much, don't they like just give money to people and say, just do it in the Midwest and places like that, and then the content comes back? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I don't want to speak for exactly how they do physical production, because I'm sure it's changed, but you know, I think they film some stuff kind of quote-unquote in-house, and some of it's more distributed, and they avail themselves of kind of passionate horror filmmakers who may be here or may not be.
So one thing, let's just say that I was to do a movie, I'm going to come up with a movie right now, it's Rob Fishman and Nick Bilton go to Middle Earth, because we want to have some dragons.
Are you Gandalf and I'm the Hobbit?
We could do that. You're a producer. So let's just say, so we can go along and we could go and try to sell it to like Warner or Netflix or something like that. But we couldn't. So we got a little bit of money. We got like $1 million, let's say. And we're going to dress in costumes right now. And we're going to go shoot it. And the option is that we could try to sell it to a distributor, a buyer. Of course, no one wants, because it's not that good of a movie. Or we could put it on YouTube. And given that it's us and how famous we are in the tween market, let's just say it gets 1 billion views. Is that a potential distribution model that could kind of disrupt the way Hollywood works today?
Maybe at 1 billion views. The problem is at 1 million or even 10 million views, no.
Because it's not
even
enough
eyeballs?
It's
more than enough eyeballs. I mean, someone told me the other day and I had mentioned this to you, if you're in good shape on a YouTube or a Facebook, for every hour that someone watches you, you might expect to make 3 or 4 cents.
Wait, so you make 3 cents if someone watches your shows for an hour?
Right. I mean, compare that to a Captain Marvel, where someone goes for an hour and a half and they pay, how much is a movie ticket now? 20, 25 bucks? Who knows?
That's the price of a Cheerios. We should ask CEO of Starbucks.
No, but you know, people talk about digital dimes and analog dollars. It's oftentimes more like digital pennies. And you know, the challenge is that the social media platforms are incredible. They're great places to build an audience, but very hard to build a business, because they have not yet invested in the sort of business models that support premium content. So look, if you can make the next Despacito, which is like, you know, something on YouTube that's done, I don't know how many, a billion or whatever.
What is Despacito? I'm aging myself.
It's a music video. Or,
got
you know, like...
Oh, got it. Oh, the one that got like 1 trillion billion views.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. You know, sure, then that's a workable model. But like, if you want to run a high production business on somewhere like YouTube, you need to be spitting out video after video that breaks and re-breaks and breaks anew the internet.
But isn't there one of the challenges right now for people that are trying to disrupt Hollywood is that the distribution methods are that you have to go through the same distributors that you
through the gatekeepers.
Through the gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers, I mean, I know people who have insane amounts of funding for their companies, and even if they have a star and a director and everything attached, the gatekeepers can still say no because we don't want to distribute it.
Right.
How do you change that?
So I think, you know, there's one model that is sort of working is you become, and you know, you could list a bunch off the top of your head, I'm sure, is people who are using YouTube or the free internet to build a big audience and then convert that into a sale to an HBO show or a Netflix show, right? I think, you know, there are stand-up comedians and there are musicians
and podcasts.
And podcasters who are basically leveraging the audience that they develop for free into those kind of gatekeeper approved deals where they're making so-called real money, right? So that's one model. But, you know, in terms of is there a near-term future where people can totally bypass Hollywood and make real money, I think the jury is still out. You know, you have to be someone like our company's investing in a huge direct ad sales team because that's how we're going to make money. It's not readily like if we were just, you know, we did close to 3 billion minutes watched last year. And I say that not to pat myself on the back, but just to say it's a lot of billion minutes watched. And like without going out and selling the ads ourselves, there's no way we're going to, you know, make ends meet.
We actually did 3 billion minutes on Nick and Rob went to Middle Earth, just watched last week. So you know, I'm patting myself on the back.
Now we're
too.
Making a sequel. The Two Towers.
All right. So someone who, there are very few people, I think, who come from Silicon Valley and then eventually come to Hollywood to start companies here. What are some of, if you were kind of looking at ways in which Silicon Valley might disrupt Hollywood, and we're starting to see the beginnings of it. I mean, first of all, you had the Amazons and Netflix, that you have Apple, Facebook, YouTube, and things like that. What do you think it is that they will do to try to disrupt this industry? Because so I was at dinner the other night with a couple of people from Hollywood, and they will probably be listening, and they were saying, oh, people come to this town all the time saying they're going to change it, and it never happens. And my response to them is, I heard that about the music industry and journalism and publishing right before it was disrupted. And when I look at this industry and I just see how wasteful and ridiculous it is, it just seems like it's just, I don't know if it's days, weeks, months, or years away, but it is going to happen. How do you think that Silicon Valley will actually end up having an impact?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think ultimately gatekeepers subsist on barriers to entry, and the cost of entry in this case is cost, right? You need money. Like, we're not going to make our Hobbit movie without that $1 million to fund it, even if we're able to find a workable business model. And, you know, most people aren't able to take $1 million of disposable income to make a movie, right? So as long as it costs a lot to make projects, even, you know, if it's $500,000, it's still a lot, then the gatekeepers will continue to exist. So then the question becomes, is there hardware that's coming, or is there some sort of software that's coming that's going to make premium content creation easier? And I think that to an extent it's been, you know, democratized. You think about like Casey Neistat biking around New York City with his camera and creating, you know, pretty, and then editing them himself and making really great YouTube videos. But by and large, right, when you're going to have a crew and film a real show, you need a crew. And, you know, I went a few months ago to see the Red cameras that they develop, which are kind of what Peter Jackson filmed Lord of the Rings on, and they were developing some incredible stuff. And, you know, you see Samsung and these other companies developing mobile phones that maybe can replace camera rigs and lights. But, you know, I don't know that the iPhone is going to replace the 30-person TV crew anytime soon.
But Steven Soderbergh just did a movie where he shot the whole thing on an iPhone, didn't he? Was that...
Yeah, but I bet you if you looked at the budget for that, it was low, but not the kind of budget where you and I are going to go shoot a movie on our iPhones.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
All right, don't get jealous, ladies and gentlemen, but I am sitting here right now with a New Yorker tote bag, and you too can have one of those if you sign up for the New Yorker, and they have a special, special, special deal for Hive listeners this week. So the New Yorker represents some of the best writing in America today. Beyond just publishing the best writers in the world, the New Yorker holds people in power accountable through rigorous reporting and compelling storytelling, both online and in print. The New Yorker covers a full range of topics from politics, news, international affairs, climate change, the environment, popular culture, the arts, fictions, food, humor, and of course, the thing that gets me up in the morning and makes me want to pick up the magazine, the cartoons. They are the best. The New Yorker, every people there, you know, they write beautifully. They write incredibly deep dives on topics that you normally wouldn't even think that you could even write a couple of words about, like paper jams and fault lines and heirloom beans and stink bugs, an amazing article you should go read. They have some of the greatest writers around that have all won Pulitzers and all sorts of different prizes. You've got Helen Rosner, James Beard Award-winning food writer. You have Hilton Ends, the theater critic. You have, of course, Ronan Farrow, who broke all the big stories on Harvey Weinstein and Les Moonves. It's an amazing magazine. It's an amazing website. They publish constantly new stories every day. They have a special offer for us Hive listeners. Not only do you get a tote bag, but you can also get 12 weeks for just $6, plus the New Yorker tote bag. You get home delivery of the print edition each week, unlimited access to thenewyorker.com, where they publish 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every single day, access to their apps, online archives, crossword puzzles, and more. Go to newyorker.com/hive, and you will get 50% off when you enter the code HIVE. That's newyorker.com/hive. Just $6, less than the price of a cup of coffee. And trust me, I've already had 17 cups of coffee today. You can get The New Yorker for just $6, 12 issues, and 50% off. All right, so when earlier this year, or the last couple of years, we've seen this instance happen where stars no longer sell big TV shows or big movies. You've seen flop after flop after flop with $20, $40 million budgets that were just spent on Jennifer Lawrence and Chris What's-His-Face and all these people that used to ensure that a movie would be successful and no longer are. So I have two questions here, and I'll ask them back to back. So one is, do you think that the star is essentially on the decline in Hollywood because they don't guarantee a hit anymore? A. And B, we are about to enter an era where you already started to see it in Star Wars, where certain actors are not real. They're CGI. They're computer generated. And we're about to enter an era where the technology is going to be so good. In fact, I think it's like 99% there already, that you won't know who's real and who's not. And therefore, you will start to see films and TV shows where there are not actors. Do you think that the star is kind of coming to the end?
A Star is Dead?
A Star is Dead.
That could be our
third movie. That's the title for our third movie, yeah.
Well, I think that there's a systemic reason, you know, to answer your first question, which is that, you know, at least for the time being, windowing is tougher because places like Netflix are, you know, buying out projects.
Explain what windowing is again.
In other words, you know, a star-driven project used to, you would air it for the first time domestically on TV, and then because such a big name was in it, you could sell foreign rights and elsewhere, and people would pay to run that show or run that movie in foreign territories. You know, now if Netflix is buying or incubating the project, right, and holding it in perpetuity, that windowing doesn't exist. So you're not, you know, you would have a star and get paid over and over and over again for that star power. So I think that that's probably one factor in this. But then from the other end, your question about do stars matter as much as legitimate? And, you know, when I look, even in our sort of demographic neck of the woods, which is young adult, I look at what Netflix is doing with Stranger Things or The Kissing Booth, you know, they're able to take virtually unknown young talent, put them on screen. And I'm sure you and a bunch of people saw the article of how their Instagram following has increased since those kids have been on Stranger Things. And we see the same effect on our shows where, you know, someone's on Chicken Girls and they gain a million followers over the year. And so that, I think when you asked the earlier question about is Netflix disrupting the process, you know, it's not necessarily that talent doesn't matter, but you don't necessarily need to pay the premium to get huge talent in your project if you have the kind of built-in distribution that places like Netflix do. You can take raw talent and turn them into big names that you effectively control because they're, you know, you introduce them.
Do you think that we're going to hit a point pretty soon where you're going to start to see TV shows and movies and things that are made where the actors are not real actors and that they are CGI versions of them?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, more and more I watch things on Netflix and elsewhere where I don't offhand, you know, maybe I'll recognize a few of the actors, but I don't know who they are. And, you know, I was thinking of Umbrella Academy I just watched, and a lot of those characters were, you know, there was a chimpanzee and other people who, you know, they weren't people who are CGI.
Wait, that wasn't a real chimpanzee that was speaking the whole time?
That's how they're doing the international rights, based on the chimp who played it. No, but I think that, you know, whether those are, like, obviously Carrie Fisher was recreated in that other Star Wars movie. And, you know, I don't know how far off that is. And I'm sure that there will be a world of legal pain when people are negotiating for someone's digital likeness. But I think that and all of these things we've been talking about are contributory factors in changing the star system and the packaging system that's existed for the last bunch of decades.
So one other thing that I keep thinking a lot about is you know, you can see with books for the first time that in Kindle, let's say if you 10 years ago you wrote a book and the book you put it out there and it didn't do well. you wouldn't know why. You just know it didn't do well. What you wouldn't know specifically was that maybe it was a 20-chapter book and the first 18 chapters were the greatest things on earth and the last two were garbage and therefore no one finished it and recommended it to anyone else. But with the Kindle, you can see as an author, and even if you're not the author, you can see where people stop reading. And there's people that are exploring the idea of like, okay, well, do we re-release the book if people stop reading after chapter 7 and rewrite chapter 7 because we understand there's something wrong with it? You could imagine if Amazon really wanted to, that they could allow you to do that on the fly as you're kind of getting feedback back. Do you think that when you apply the Silicon Valley model to Hollywood, that we could end up in a situation where we are editing and redistributing and repackaging films and TV shows with, maybe it's with CGI actors, maybe it's not, on the fly based on different people's preferences?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of choose your own adventure and make your own adventure is, I think, an intriguing one. You know, due to the way that things are shot with block shooting and kind of finding all these efficiencies, sometimes those efficiencies are the enemy of doing what you're talking about, which is, you know, you film a project over 30 days and it's certainly not in any order from a, you know, script chronology perspective. And so by the time the thing's done, it's done. Now, the question of after it's done, you release it and you recut it. You know, I think that, to go back to what we were saying earlier, for these other types of media where it's just cheaper to make them, it's also cheaper to remake them and to recut them. And, you know, there's a difference, I think, between going in and editing versus, you know, every movie you hear people saying, oh, I'm doing reshoots for 20 days. And those are probably as expensive, if not more, than, you know, what those days would have been on the principal shoot. So, you know, I think that these kind of frontier technologies that you're talking about, whether it's CGI or remixing projects, are sound great in practice, but I don't know that they ultimately implicate the fundamental cost structure of why Hollywood projects cost so much.
One thing that you hear a lot about is that you'll see an idea and someone will write a script and they'll get paid a couple hundred grand to do it. And then they bring in someone else who's a huge name to rewrite it and they get paid $1 million. And then another person redoes a million and this. And then it just sits on a shelf for 10 years and then they scrap it and start over. And is that because the industry, I understand that, okay, if you're going to do a big movie and it's going to cost you tens of millions of dollars, you want to make sure you get it right. But when I look at, you know, when you look at the journalism industry, for example, you could spend a year working on a story or you could spend a week working on a story. And there are some stories that deserve a year, but most stories that do not. And my belief is that the end product is going to be pretty similar. And do you think that there's a system, there's a system of waste that is built in for a reason? Or is this just people that don't know what they're doing?
I think the reason is in part to breed, you know, strong quality projects, but in part it is to keep the gatekeepers alive, right? I mean, the model of we'll make a bunch of stuff and throw it against the wall and see what the audience like is a very kind of internet new age driven philosophy. And it's more similar to what, you know, a BuzzFeed or Huffington Post or any of those folks do, right?
Or any tech startup.
Any tech startup, right? It's like, let's try a bunch of things. Let's be iterative. Let's beta test.
Move fast and break things.
Move fast, break things. And I think, right, move fast, break things is really interesting because I think the ideal of Hollywood is move slowly and break nothing except, you know, box office numbers. And so I don't think that, I think, you know, the more and more there's a democracy of choice and of filmmakers and creatives, the less and less relevant these people who control the studios and the agencies are. And so, yeah, there's an inherent and endemic motivation for them to keep these productions tight and to not allow everything that gets made to be seen. And so projects, you know, do sit around and turn around for years or decades. And I think that's all part of the system.
So essentially what this all comes down to is the reason for all the inefficiency here is because of the gatekeepers that have designed it to be so.
Well, right. I mean, I think Silicon Valley has gatekeepers in its own sort of hidden in an obscure way, but you know, what we see from the user perspective is like, we've created a platform and you guys should use it however you want. And we're not ourselves, you know, we, the platform's going to interject unless you break certain rules. I think the Hollywood system is almost the mirror image, which is you're going to be the consumer who sits in the movie theater and we're going to pick a very few projects to show you and we will define taste and, you know, define culture and you'll watch.
And that's how we have some of these diabolical, terrible movies that no one goes to see and that flop at the movie theater and so on.
Sure. And you know, I think like you could say the same thing about social media. Every 99 out of 100 posts you read on Twitter or Facebook, you're like, gosh, I sure wish I hadn't seen that. And then you see one thing and you're like, oh, well, that was actually really interesting. So I'm not sure that the hit ratio is all that different. It's just kind of coming through a different model.
When you look at so you've done a lot of work with data in when you were at Twitter and places like that. Do you think that data can inform the kinds of things that are made or the way that they're made, or is it not applied to that?
I'm generally pretty skeptical. I think you can use data to inform, you know, demographics or what talent is picking up steam or you know, any of these other variables. But in terms of like what makes a hit, I think, and you know, you would know this better than I would, you're writing these projects out here, like it's really hard. I think that, you know, the hardest thing to automate is creativity. And, you know, it, even for our own shows, I'm often surprised at what seems to really do well versus what I think is going to do well. And we have, you know, talent who's oftentimes native to the internet. We're on the internet. We have all of the numbers coming in. And like, you know, I think that there's something to be said for whatever it is that just connects with fans.
So your company, Brat, you specialize in YA. Am I allowed to say the word tween? Is that a legal word? I don't even know.
We certainly have a lot of tweens who watch our shows, and you know, there are tweens in the shows. I think, you know, coming of age, young adult is probably the right sort of.
And so you're how old are you?
33.
So how did you end up deciding to go after the young adult tween market? Because that would be the last place I would probably go.
No, I think that's a great question. I mean, you know, part of it gets back to what we've been talking about earlier. I mean, you know, part of it was what we saw at our last company, which was, you know, specifically young adults were not watching television anymore. So
your last company was?
Our last company was called Niche. It did a lot of the marketing for digital talent and helping them run branded campaigns.
Which was acquired by Twitter.
Yeah. So, you know, we spent a lot of time with these digitally native pieces of talent who themselves and their fans were just not watching television anymore. And so that sort of inspired a lot of our thinking. And then, you know, we thought back to like the John Hughes movies and the Brat Pack and said, hey, there's something that's missing from this generation. And that's what kind of inspired us. But I forget, your original question was...
What made you decide?
Oh, YA.
Yeah.
So, you know, having spent some time with and learned from, you know, Jack Davis at Crypt TV, or even Jason Blum, who makes movies, you know, from a notoriously good price point and makes oodles of money. You know, the reason horror movies, from what I understand, work is because you don't necessarily need these huge names attached, because
you just have to scare the shit out of people.
They all get killed anyway. Exactly. You all have to get scared. And the other genre that you're able to pull off on a relatively good price point is high school movies. And, you know, I think that's what was the fun of the John Hughes movies, was not that there was robots or dragons or any other kind of CGI. They were just great kind of iconic coming of age stories. And so, you know, that was also part of it was the idea that we could, you know, look at like a Roger Corman inspired production model and actually tell good
What's
stories.
What's a Roger Corman inspired production model?
So that, you know, he was sort of the king of B movies and was able to just produce on a real budget, like on a real budget.
And so his model and the B movie model and everything, why did it go away? Because of the gatekeepers or...
Well, I think it kind of comes back to what we were saying before about, you know, soap operas and all of these unsexy formats of entertainment that are a lot more cost conscious, but really like connect with an audience in a more day-to-day way that aren't splashy. And I think that, you know, the roads sort of diverge where now it's either the Avengers or it's a, you know, political video with some chyrons that is thrown up on Facebook. And that's where I think we've gone so high-low that we're really missing the vast middle. And I actually think that middle is what was the connective tissue for most of the country. And when I think about, you know, what's wrong with everything today, I actually think that that's a big piece of it, is that we're missing the kind of bread and butter entertainment that really everyone congregated around.
And do you think that that can come back?
Yeah, I do. I think people like us or Crypt or any of these companies are starting to think about how do we make entertainment that is affordable and you know, achievable, and that we can run through the phone and modern means of distribution without breaking the bank, that that mass audiences actually do look at. And you know, that's kind of like the provide touchstones for these generations who are now coming of age. Because you know, when you and I grew up, and you know, I don't want to lump you into my generation as your Gandalf.
I'm pretty close.
But, you know, I think we can all remember like those iconic moments from Saved by the Bell or Dawson's Creek.
I didn't watch Dawson's Creek, but I did watch Saved by the Bell.
You know, I'm so excited. I'm so scared. Like, and then I think you look at people who are growing up today and they maybe have never watched anything that the person next to them has watched because they're all, you know, watching different things. And so I think that that common sense and common ground entertainment is something that really needs to come back into the conversation.
So years ago, actually about a decade ago, exactly a decade ago, I came out to California to work on my first book, which no one should read. And it was about looking at the future of media. This was, you know, no one was using Twitter. No one was really on Facebook or anything like that. It was all very esoteric at the time. And I came out here kind of looking at different industries to kind of identify what was going to happen to the media industry. And the industry that I specifically came out to look at was the porn industry. I know you've never looked at porn. I've never looked at porn, so I don't know a lot about it. But what I did hear, and it was pretty fascinating back then, was they were always – the porn has always, of course, been at the forefront of everything with VHS tapes and DVDs and 800 numbers and this, that, and the other. And so I wanted to see what technologies they were using at the time that could kind of – look at the future of media. And there was a lot of stuff that I don't need to get into, but there was stuff that there was one thing specifically that I found fascinating. And they said that you will, that what they were starting to do was create content for a billion different audiences. So if you're into people who wear stockings and glasses while having sex, like if that was your thing, 10,000 people would pay for that. And if you were into, you know, there's a whole porn thing called like Pirates of the Caribbean, but it's a different name. I forget what it is. But like there are families that, not families, husbands and wives that will watch that together. And they were saying that if you create these 10,000 different genres, people will pay for it, which was happening. And I always wondered how, and I think that that is true in some respects for media today. We have a million different kinds of medias. You can get, you know, things on any different kind of content you want. Do you think that that is ever going to apply to the kind of film television industry? And just one last part of that is, you know, if you watched The Cosbys or a show like that 20, 30 years ago, 60, 70 million people tuned into that. Today, if 3 million people tune into Breaking Bad, that's a huge, huge hit. And so it looks like we're going towards this thing where you have a smaller audience to have a bigger hit. Do you think that we'll get to a point where you could see, you know, 10,000 different projects a year that are designed for little esoteric audiences?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer your first question with sort of a funny story. When we were starting our company and trying to pilot out a lot of these concepts, we were looking to film things in really cheap locations. And the advice I got was to go up to, you know, up north of Hollywood. And someone said, oh, you can get great studio space in Chatsworth. I didn't know what Chatsworth was, but among other things, it's apparently where, you know, many of the pornography films are made because of their cheap production. And, you know, we went up there. It was pretty seedy. I mean, you know, we picked fine places to film our shows. But, you know, in the middle of one of our shoots, one of the talent who was on our shows, who was, you know, an actor, had done a campaign recently through my old company, through Niche, which was part of Twitter. And someone on the set told him that I'd started that company and sold it. And, you know, he said, like, what the hell are you doing up here? And, you know, so I've always hear about how, you know, the pornography industry is like leading the way in terms of technology development. But I think that the economies that of scale and the way that they're able to find efficiencies of cost is in a one small way, at least, was instructive of like find locations and do things at a price where you can, you know, eventually recoup a profit. And I think like that's a model that everyone needs to learn. And I think that as we, you know, move into the age of all these streaming services who are trying to go direct to consumer, right? And basically get, you know, cut through some of the fat and say, you're going to pay us directly and we're going to make these shows for you on our service. All of those folks are going to need to figure out how to make lower cost programming, because there isn't going to be like windowing like we talked about before, and you're going to need to make a product and figure out how to get people to pay for it, which is what, you know, without necessarily having billions of dollars of debt eventually. And so I think that, you know, we are all going to have to learn to be scrappier. And I think that, to me, that's the kind of key takeaway. And your second question was...
Well, I think it's just the question is, I guess you, I you know, you hearing you talk about Netflix repeatedly, I guess kind of answers that. You know, everyone makes fun of Netflix because there's like a 100 new shows a week, and everyone's like, what the hell? Who would watch that? But it's
well, I think, I mean, I do think, oh yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, look, everyone has their own Netflix is kind of the theory there, right? That you have your Netflix and I have mine, and it's not divided up into discrete networks. I personally... think things will and should go a little bit more in the other direction, which is back toward mass programming. I think that there's a lot of isolation and kind of tribalism and ugly feelings in the country because everyone's, you know, listening to and reading the things that they care about. And I hope that we return to an age of mass programming where people are all watching the same thing. And like, you know, to return for a second to what we're doing, you know, when we aired our holiday movie, which was a very cheery kind of Christmas special with a bunch of the stars from our show, YouTube allows you to premiere these things. So you can actually see how many people are waiting for it to go live. And there were almost 75,000 of our viewers who were sitting around for like 10 minutes waiting for it. And, you know, I think that's exciting for us, and it's heartening to see, because it means that, and there's a live chat going on, so they're all talking, right, about what's going to happen and talking about internet memes that I can barely grasp. But, you know, I think that we need more of that and less of everyone having their own personal window.
So you believe that part of the problem with the country today is as a result of the divide in media too?
100%. I mean, I think it's probably a little more pronounced on like the news media side than the entertainment side, but I think it's totally true of shows as well. Like if we're all watching our own shows and reading our own websites, like what are we talking about with each other?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's the big problem with like the Fox News, MSNBC is that, you know, they're just yelling at, they're not yelling. They're justifying everyone's exact viewpoint, and that's why you tune in. There should be like a thing where you turn on the TV and say you want to watch the news, and it like scrambles through and just randomly lands on something, and that's the one you have to watch that night.
Yeah, I mean, you remember like even 10 years ago, you would watch the Oscars, and everyone in the room had seen every movie, and now when I go to an Oscars party, no one has seen any of the movies. And I just think like there's something, and maybe I'm being nostalgic, but there's something sad about that.
Yeah. No, I hear you. All right. So if you could predict what Hollywood will look like 5 years from now, what do you think it's going to look like? Or should we do 10 years from now?
Well, I think on the 5-year horizon, I'm not sure how different it's going to look. I think that a lot of the streaming services, which are either replacing or consolidating with the studios, as we've sort of talked about, are doing things a little bit differently and a little more data-driven and, you know, changing the way that we consume content. But in terms of the industry here that's producing that content, like, it's been a golden age, right? You know, and I think when you go talk to agents who are packaging showrunners into big deals with the streamers, like, there's never been more being made. And so obviously, you know, there's been this big debate over packaging these last few weeks, but by and large, I actually think that it's emboldened a lot of what exists out here.
What do you mean? The packaging has?
No, sorry. The rise of digital streamers.
Got it.
I think has in some ways been a lifeline for the industry out here rather than a disruptive force.
Got it.
But, you know, in 10 years, I think a lot of what happens in 10 years will really depend, you know, the bigger giants, obviously, in the space are the Amazons and the Facebooks and the YouTubes. And, you know, I think that some of them have been doing really interesting stuff in the Hollywood space. And, you know, I was just with my friend Ricky, who does Facebook Watch, and they have, you know, some incredibly successful hits like Red Table Talk. And that's become like, you know, a national phenomenon, right? And I think if the Facebooks and YouTubes and Amazons and others and Apples, you know, start to invest a little more heavily in building out ecosystems for professionalized content, you could see other pathways emerge where people are doing things differently. But right now, if you make a show for any of the places I just mentioned, I'm not sure the process is fundamentally that different from if you make a project for Paramount or Warner's.
Do you think that, what was the last time you went to the movies, out of curiosity?
I go to see Marvel movies.
You do. You go.
I mean,
to
that's
see,
it.
But you used to go to the movies a lot, right? Like,
sure.
Like all of us. I used to. So this we all predicted years and years ago. Eventually, our televisions would get so big that there would be no point for us to go to the movies. And
soon our phones will get so big we'll have no point for the television.
For television, and then we'll put a little chip in our brain, and then we won't have any point for the phone. But eventually, the movie theater goes away, and there's a world in which some people talk about when they talk about like net neutrality and so on. There's a world in which when the movie theater goes away, and we have these massive TVs, that you could imagine that you could bypass the streamers too by having your own app or website or whatever that you can stream your. Maybe it's by this point making our movie. What was the movie called again?
The Return of King Nick Bilton.
The Return of The Journey to Middle Earth with Nick Bilton and Rob Fishman. You can imagine that maybe we could do it because the Red camera's cheaper, or the iPhone camera's so amazing, or whatever. Or there's an algorithm like an app, just like you can edit photos now. There's one that will edit your movie together for you. Do you think that we get to a point where we do see the opportunity for people to bypass those gatekeepers finally and go straight to the consumer?
Look, I mean, we're trying, right? But the hard reality is when I talk to my head of production or my head of post-production or my head of development, you know, they still need people with expensive equipment and people with great talent and so on to make these projects. And, you know, I think back to 10 years ago when I was working at the Huffington Post and there were like 20 of us sitting in a loft in Soho writing the news, and you had one person who was the entertainment editor, and they did 20 million uniques by writing articles, maybe with them and one associate. And, you know, I just think that's so much harder to port into the entertainment space. I think that there's, of course, the rise of vlogging and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think for us to make our movie and send it direct to consumer, to people's home theaters, we still need to have some sort of ecosystem that either, you know, pays us or reimburses us or gets users to pay for it. And I don't know where that's coming from and when.
Do you believe VR is actually going to be a thing that people consume content on, or is it just going to be for video games?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not an expert in it, but I would say making VR is a good example. Like, that's so much more expensive than making, you know, something for a single point of view, right? So it's like some of these new technologies are incredible, but the cost of production to make exciting things for those channels is astronomical.
So if the price comes down, though, will people want to consume? I mean, the question is, I guess, will we want to get to a point where we slip on a headset to watch a movie with in our living room that you're immersed in that way?
I'm sure we will, but I think that those will be made by highly specialized people who exist in ecosystems where either the consumers are paying a ton of money or the studios are financing them because they believe they can sell them for a ton of money.
All right, so last couple of questions, and then we'll let you get back to your tweens. If you were to look at the tech industry today, and what they're going to try to do in the next few years when they kind of come trouncing down to Los Angeles, do you think that there's anything that people aren't seeing that they'll be doing that is not so obvious right now?
I think that's a good question, and I think the answer from my point of view is that there are incremental changes coming, but I think, you know, when you look at a YouTube who at first launched YouTube Red and rebranded as, I guess, YouTube Originals, and, you know, recently, from what I've read, stopped making scripted content and is kind of, you know, going more back to maybe it's they're spending a little more on getting celebrities to post, like Will Smith to post kind of vlog style content. I think that the results have been pretty mixed. And I think that the Silicon Valley players who have had great success in, you know, building products, building algorithms, and kind of letting those products do the work for themselves have had a generally hard time making sense of what exists down here. You know, as I said, I'm impressed with like what Facebook does with Red Table Talk. And, you know, they've, I think our Facebook Watch is like finding formats that really works and that make sense on Facebook. But, you know, I think for most of us, if you look at the Silicon Valley players and you look at their content strategy and their output, it seems a little bit scattershot. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure where they're going to make more investments because I'm not sure where like the big wins have been and where they can compete.
Do you still use social media?
I've definitely pulled back over the last year. I mean, it used to feel fun and now it feels ugly.
It feels awful.
Yeah. Which by the way, is even more of a reason to kind of retreat into entertainment.
That was what my next question was. Yeah. It's like, does that affect? I mean, I think, you know, one thing that I've always found so fascinating is you go to these press conferences with Instagram or Facebook or even Netflix. I was there a few weeks ago for an event, and someone asked Reed Hastings, you know, who's your competitor? And he said, Fortnite, the video game. And then he joked, you know, it's really just people's time. And I think that what's been so fascinating is that years ago, it was TV shows were competing with TV shows, and there was in a specific genre and time slot. Movies were competing with movies, and now everyone's competing with everyone. But it seems like we may go back to that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Snap held their summit last week, and it was really interesting because half of the stuff they were announcing were user-generated features like incredible new camera tools, and you can make buildings jump out of the sky. But the other half were scripted shows, many of them sort of in our demographic or creator-driven shows, which exist kind of on the Discover tab. And you can see like, hey, we're making shows and you're talking here. And I think that, you know, that kind of duality will become more interesting. And I guess the real question is like, do users want more of the user-generated talk with friends stuff, or do they want to watch quality entertainment?
Well, we will find out. Where can everyone find your shows and whatnot on the internet?
Yeah, most of our episodes are on YouTube, but we post fun daily stuff on Instagram and Spotify and Amazon. So what are the
names of the websites? I mean the hand. What do we even call them anymore?
Handles.
Handles. What are your handles?
We sound like old people. On Instagram and Twitter, we're at Brat, BRAT, and I think YouTube we have a Brat YT for YouTube on the end. But generally, if you look for us, you can find us.
You use influencer tweens on your shows that then go out and share everything, right?
We have it kind of gets back to the question you were asking about Netflix. You know, we have the star of our latest popular show, Zoe Valentine, is a girl named Anna Cathcart, who was the little sister on To All the Boys I've Loved Before from Netflix. And she had been on a Disney show before that. You know, she now has a million Instagram followers. I think some people would say, oh, she's an influencer. And other people would say she's an actor, and she's both. And, you know, I think when we talk about some of the actual changes that are happening right now, I think this next generation of talent is going to look like a lot of different things and not, you know, just one.
So can I come on one of your YO shows as like a, as an in-person, I could play myself as the, in Gandalf in Lord of the Rings.
I could see maybe like a history teacher.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Rob, thank you so much for coming on today. This is a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thanks to my guests this week, Bess Levin and Rob Fishman. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen to and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. There are now well over 100 of them. You can find these on ApplePodcastRadio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thank you, of course, to my sponsors, H&R Block and The New Yorker Magazine. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you next week.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. 6 big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
from PRX.